Good morning. We are on the phone with Jim Messina.
Good morning.
We are thrilled to be talking to you, Jim. It's the other Jim, Jim Healy, and Jack here in the KRFY studio this morning. Calling, actually, it is early in the morning when we're speaking to you, although we'll be broadcasting this conversation a little later on. It is 9 o'clock in Franklin, Tennessee, and how are things for you this morning?
Oh, it's fantastic. Sun's shining, and we had some rain over the weekend. It kind of reminds me of, because it's somewhat, you know, it starts to get humid here in this part, but it kind of reminds me of, golly, living even in Hawaii, sometimes you'll get an evening shower and a morning sun, and there's a lot of a wonderful life here. Air is clean. We have lots of animals here, chickens, cats, dogs, donkeys, ducks, horses. And everybody's just out in the barnyard having a great time. Ducky.
Can I ask you a question? You're a California guy. How did you end up in Tennessee? And when did you make the move?
Well, originally, yes, I was born in California. My mother on her side, they're all from Texas. And about when I was three, I think I moved to Texas, and I was there until probably the beginning of the fourth grade. My parents on my mother's side are all from Texas and Tennessee. On my father's side, they were immigrants from Italy, so they were they started off in Colorado actually, and then moved to California. And then when I was born, I was born there. But I've always had, you know, two types of families. You know, there was the Native American redneck side of me, and then there's the Italian side of me. So I grew up with different styles of music. You know, in the Italian family, there was a lot of polkas, you know, you know, and mandolins and craziness like that. And then on the other side, it was more, I remember growing up listening to, my father was a musician, and in the 40s, but he was into Western swing, you know, Bob Wills and the Texas mm-hmm. Playboys, mm-hmm. you know, Spade Cooley and Merle Travis and Chet Atkins and that style of music. And then on the other side, they were kind of into the, I remember, you know, Johnny Cash, Hank Snow, Hank Thompson, you know, that kind of stuff. Right. So there was a whole lot of different styles of music growing up in my family. So while I was from California, I was really raised in a Texas household most of my life.
And how did Tennessee come into play?
Well, we were living in California in Santa Ynez for, I was there about 20 years. And a drought happened about 10 years into the time when I was there. And I had a small little I'd call it a casita. It was more like a little small little ranch after I had moved from Ojai, because I had a 20-acre place in Ojai, and then we moved to Santa Ynez, you know, eventually. Mm-hmm. But water got to be really scarce, and it got to be expensive. And we had, you know, farm animals there, and it became almost a desert. And they, you know, it was going to cost us $7,500 a month to just keep it green for the
Ouch.
Animals.
Wow.
And I said, boy, that's a mortgage payment in most places. So we eventually tried to weigh it out. I think about 6 years, and finally I just said, you know what, we need to find another place. Our first choice was Montana. In fact, I'd put an offer on a place there. Mm. We just love Montana. But the problem was that airplanes are so small, and for me to tour and get in and out of there was
right.
impossible. Which we decided then, how about Texas? Because again, that's where I grew up as a kid. And my family, my brother-in-law was a sheriff of Hays County, Texas. And my sister was, his wife was you know, worked for a newspaper. She was a writer. And so I had friends and family all in Texas. Merle Brigani, who was a drummer with me, and Lars Messina was there. But the taxes were too high, and while there were no state taxes, the property taxes were almost a mortgage payment. You mm-hmm. know, and so we said we got to figure out something else. So you know, I'd been coming to Tennessee for many years. I'd got an album here and have a lot of friends, and many of the friends that I had, including Michael Amardian, had moved to Tennessee. And so I thought, well, why don't we give it a try and see what's there? So we got here, and, you know, again, the taxes were very reasonable. And so we thought, let's give it a try. You know, it's in the middle, you know, kind of the middle of the East and Rocky Mountains. And I decided to go ahead and go back to an agency that I had here, which was APA at the time. Now it's Reliant. But from here, we could drive just about anywhere except for the West Coast. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't doing that many dates on the West Coast. And, you know, believe it or not, music is really happening more, I think, away from the West Coast in terms of concerts and enthusiasm. The people are more into wanting to go to a concert, and they live a more normal lifestyle, of which music and concerts and that kind of thing is really interesting to them. I just found living in California that, especially in the L.A. West Coast, is that, you know, concerts are just not what they used to be. And so for me, it was just a better place to live. I've always been sort of a Republicrat, which means I'm sort of a conservative liberal, so politics really don't interest me that much, and I kind of enjoy really living in a more conservative group. It's been better for my kid because education is so much better where we live. She's just thriving. So my daughter just turned 17.
Wow.
And my son was here in Tennessee, went to Belmont and studied. He wanted to become a recording engineer and got involved in being a recording engineer, but then moved into virtual reality and video. So he's back in California doing that. But it just, I got here because, well, I must say the gods guided me here, because this is really the right place for us to be.
And when did you make the move?
I think it was 2018.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And I would think also musically, I mean, in terms of the band that you're hitting the road with now, are they mainly from Tennessee, or is that where they're presently located? Would you like to go through the band with us?
Sure. Originally, my band was out of California, and then Craig Thomas moved to the East Coast. Gary Oliar was on the East Coast, and Michael Brady and Dave Beyer were both on the West Coast, and here I found myself in the middle. It was just getting too expensive to try to get together, bring them together to rehearse, you know, if I'm going to make a record, how do we do that? So I decided during the COVID period I would start seeing if there was an option. And I ended up, make a long story short, I ended up with a really, it took me a while, you know, 2 or 3 years, but it took me a while. But I finally found a really great group of people. I've got Jack Bruno on drums, who was with Tina Turner, Joe Cocker, Delbert McClinton. He's got a good, solid rock, blues, background, good, steady, great drummer. Found a young man about my son's age. He's 32, Benjamin King, Ben King, and plays bass and sings all the high parts. Stevie Nieves, who was with me in 2005 and 2009 with Kenny when we did our reunion tours, who's a saxophone player, percussionist, and vocalist. He's also on that video that Kenny and I did in 2005. He's just a phenomenal player, phenomenal talent. And I also have I had a violinist, Gary Oliar, but I needed a keyboard player because I'm starting now to bring in my solo works into my set, and the keyboard is really, really instrumental. And until I can get my price up a little more, I just can't afford to have, you know, more than the five of us. So he brought a really nice dimension to it. And while I missed the violin, we've been able to take those parts that were on the violin and transfer them over to keyboards, but play it on a B3. And an interesting thing is that a B3 can get a resonant sound that is close to a violin and a horn. So my preference would be to have two horn players. I have one. But we're able to take a lot of the parts on the second horn and put it over on the keyboards with the B3 and or the violin. So it allowed me to go ahead and start looking at what my set list would be. And so the way my set list works is that Never in my life have I ever sang, you know, an hour and a half straight through on every song. I've always, you know, either shared it in Poco or in Kenny and I, you know, we divided up the vocals. But now I'm singing, you know, everything. So in order to really make that work and so I'm not exhausted, and I'm also playing sometimes four or five nights in a row, we start off acoustically. And I do songs like, for instance, Thinking of You, which was a hit for L&M, and we do songs. I'll give you the set list so you get it. You asked about set list, so it's basically Thinking of You, and then we go into Watching the River Run. We do House at Per Corner. We do Danny's Song from the L&M stuff. And then I start to move into some of my solo works, which is a song called Whispering Waters, which I recorded on the Messina album. And from there, I do another song called Mexican Minutes, which was a song that I wrote here in Nashville probably in 1994 or something like that, maybe. And Brooks and Dunn covered it, put it on one of their albums. So I've started including that into my set. It's kind of a fun song to do. And then I'll start moving into my country portion of my career. I do Better Think Twice by Poco. I do... listen to a country song, and Holiday Hotel is a medley. And for those folks who've listened to country music, Len Anderson had a hit on Listen to a Country Song. And then depending on what the venue wants, we'll either take a well, actually then after that we do Your Mama Don't Dance. And then depending on what the venue wants, we'll either break for an intermission or we'll keep going. And then at that point, I come back and I do a couple of songs for my solo albums, one from Oasis called New and Different Way, and another song from the Messina album called Loving You Every Minute. And this is where this particular band shines, because Steve Nieves is a percussionist, and we've got able to get some of the horn parts over there on the B3. You know, there's some parts that go, ba-da-da-da-da-do-do-do-do-da-da-do-do-do-do-da. And that's all done on keyboard and saxophone, and it just really turned out great. But it's more of a Latin rock feeling, and Steve Nieves brings that quality, given his genre and experience, to really highlight those songs and make them feel like the original arrangements. I really stick to the arrangements that were originally done for a couple of reasons. I know Kenny's always criticized me on this, but I do believe, from my point of view, in my opinion, is that when people come to see the music that they heard over the years, they want to hear it the way they remember it, you know, not the way the artist thinks it should be now. And I know for myself, when I would listen to the Everly Brothers, and I would hear a song that they had re-recorded, not that I didn't like it, but I always was very fond of hearing the original arrangement. I Bless the Day I Found You with the Everly Brothers. Let It Be Me. Let It Be Me is just a phenomenal. Or Wake Up Little Susie. Or, I just love the original arrangements. And, of course, the sound is the sound. So I really work to keep that in the arrangement so people can come and go, wow, I remember that. And those songs bring back memories. It's kind of like, you know, the smell of grandma's cooking. You know, you go, oh yeah, I remember those biscuits, and I remember that, or this, or the cake. And then I'll, you know, from that we start moving into some familiar stuff that I wrote and gave to Kenny back in the early days of Sitting In. The Trilogy was a group of songs that I had written and arranged to help make that album be the best that it could be. So I brought that back into my set. I'm also doing songs like Changes and Angry Eyes. I like to show the guys off. So there's a couple of songs, like one in You Need a Man, where it's a lengthy instrumental that allows everybody a chance to express themselves. And that's where you start finding the elements of blues and jazz in these players, because they're just also phenomenal, and people like to hear that. They like to see it. So we give that, and You Need a Man. We also in Angry Eyes gives a chance that particular arrangement was extended. And then And then we end it with, if we get a second encore, we end it with a new song I have called She's Got a Rock. And it's a fun evening.
Well, it sounds like it. A lot of hits in there, and then some other more obscure kind of numbers too. Are your bandmates mostly kind of out of the Nashville area? Is that?
Yes, I eventually was able to find players here, many of which were uprooted from, you know, Boston or California or other places around the country. It appears that what's happened over the years is there's been an exodus from especially Los Angeles, because the music scene isn't what it used to be like, and we can tell that in the music that's being produced. Not that the music is bad, but it's just the styles are so different nowadays. Whereas in the Nashville area, there's such a melting pot of genre, you know, from rap to Latin to country to rock. You know, you have so many different choices to choose from players. And for me, that was the best situation, because I could go in and plum pick the people who had the history of playing with various artists of various different genres, and be able to grab the right person for this particular situation, because this is not just about Loggins and Messina. It's about Poco, Buffalo, Springfield, and of course who I am as a solo artist.
It's nice to hear that you're not afraid to kind of go back into your history. I like that you're going to be playing things kind of in the style in which they were originally recorded too. We pulled up your internet, you know, your history as recorded by the internet. And it looks like you recorded your first album when you were 16 with the Jesters. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think I was actually 15 years old.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. I was, probably in the 10th grade.
Wow. Does any of that appear on your, going to be making an appearance?
Not yet, but we've been joking around about it. My guitar tech's daughter, she's 19, and part of her music appreciation class was she was supposed to go out and do some history, and she started looking up, found this album by the Buffalo Springfield, and she she saw my name on it. She goes, Oh, Daddy, you know that guy you're working with, Jim Messina? He was in this group called Buffalo Springfield. And he laughs. He goes, yeah, I know. And she goes, oh, well, I didn't. And then she says, about 2 weeks later, oh, Daddy, I found this album by him when he was 15. So it was really interesting to hear these little voices and little bodies and little souls start discovering the music and being excited about it. So he said to me, he says, you know, you might not have considered doing that. And I said, man. I said, I listened to that album, and all I hear is a 15-year-old with angst in their body. And then about, I guess, 2 years ago, there is a Jim Messina tribute band of that period out there. And I get a call, I get an email, somebody, hey, would you like to come and join us? And I said, you know what, God bless you, but you do a much better job than I ever could now. So I don't know. We might do it for fun. I mean, we have the album. It's there for sale. We won't be bringing any merch right now, but we do have that album for sale on CD. I don't handle that part of my career, but it might be on Bandcamp or one of those, those places.
Yeah, I'd like to ask you, Jim, you brought up the 15-year-old Jim Messina. Where you are now, what would you say to the 15-year-old Jim Messina, having experienced what you've experienced? What would you say to that young child that's still inside you, I imagine?
Oh, yeah. You know, no one's ever asked me that question, but I would tell him, good job. You followed the right pathways. You made the right decisions. It was never easy. It was never free. It still isn't. I've had to work at every aspect that I have done in order to have just enough achievements to get me where I am. But, you know, when I was 15, I was discovered by a guy named Larry Goldberg. And that was Audio Fidelity. And then about a year and a half later, a DJ by the name of Glenn Edwards who was working at KECY at the Disneyland Hotel, discovered me in my high school year. Then he asked me to produce records, which I did not know what that meant. And when he explained what he needed from me, I felt, well, hell, that's what I do every day when I'm rehearsing. So I went to work on the weekends during my high school years to produce records for Ibis Records. And at that time, I met a gentleman, a young man, about 4 years older than I was. He's about 24, named Mike Dureau. And Mike Dureau was the engineer at the studio called Emperor Productions, which was owned by Bob Hudson, who was the top DJ at the time at KRLA in Los Angeles, who later became part of a comedy team called Hudson and Lambert. And once I had finished work, you know, I'd go there on the weekends and work, and then once I finally graduated, I worked for another 6 months. But that label didn't do well, and so, you know, he closed it down, and I thought I was going to be, you know, a studio musician. My stuff was the best, and when I got into the sessions, you know, there were people playing guitar like James Burton and Barney Kessel and, you know, Glenn Campbell, and I just, you know, Joe Osborne. I just went, you know, I'm just not as good as these guys are, and I'm not going back to San Bernardino. So I asked Mike Dureau if I could be an apprentice under him and learn how to become a recording engineer. So I made that conscious choice because, you know, certainly I didn't want to starve and I didn't want to not be around the music, and I was not quite ready to become a professional musician. And that led me into learning how to build studios with him. We did a lot of installs. I learned how to wire patch bays, line tape machines. I learned how to edit with a razor blade. I learned how to master albums. I learned how to operate delays and compressors and equalizers and what they do and how they are to be used to make sound better. So that whole education for me, I was thrilled that I was able to do it. I was exhausted. We were starving. It was hard to make money, but it was extremely important. As I look back at the 75-year-old talking to that now 16-year-old, 17-year-old, that you know, without that experience, for example, once Mike and I got two jobs. One was to build a studio for Joe Osborne, the bass player I just mentioned, who was on just about every hit record. And you would also would have known him if anyone watched the Ozzie and Harriet show. James Burton and Joe Osborne were the backup musicians in that particular.
Okay.
So we as a kid, I used to see him play, but I didn't know who he was until I got to Hollywood. And Joe, you know, wanted to build a little home studio, so Michael and I built that for him. He couldn't afford to pay me. I would have helped Michael anyway, but he couldn't afford to pay me. He said that right out, and I said, "Well, I'll tell you what." I said, "I'd like to learn my way around on a bass guitar. I play guitar. I was wondering if, when you're home now and then, if you could just spend a little time with me, I'd appreciate it." Which he agreed to do, and so I learned some of his chops and some of his way of looking at things on his from his point of view, which I loved his playing. And eventually, when I started, let me just stop right there. He helped me to do that. And then we got a job working in building a studio called Universal Sound is what it was, on Sunset Boulevard down near Vermont. And a couple of guys had a Texas investor, and Al Jones, Sonny Jones, their sister used to be married to the late Hank Williams, and Johnny Horton. They wanted a studio, so Mike and I built that. And then once it was finished, they needed an engineer, and Mike was always off doing something. So I stayed there for a while and was their mixing engineer. And on the first sessions that came in, people that showed up were Joe Osborne, James Burton, Keith Allison, Jerry Allison, Roger Miller, Dorsey Burnett. And suddenly I was sitting in a room full of all the rockabilly players I'd ever loved listening to on the radio. and I'm actually, you know, mixing some of their sound. So it was all of that experience, and having Joe kind of help me when one day I'm producing, you know, the Buffalo Springfield, and they lose their bass player, and I raised my hand for the audition and got the job. So backing up here, if it hadn't have been for me working hard to become an engineer and offering my services for free to help build Joe's studio, I would have never learned my way around on the bass or felt confident enough to raise my hand and eventually get that job.
Wow.
That's... So, you know, to answer your question, as I look back, I don't think that any of the choices that I made altered who I eventually have become. I'm sure there's some regrets in there someplace, but I think the thing that I appreciate the most is I was able to. I was thinking about this the other night. It was a kind of a serious thought, but I realized in answering your question that the journey to become successful is a hard path for most people. But the most difficult path to walk is not becoming successful, but surviving success. Because when I look at some of my, you know, compadres and what has happened with them once they became successful, the indulgences and you name it, and the health issues and, you know, just making poor choices lifestyle-wise has been the demise of many. And to, you know, and that's what I mean by surviving. And I'm very fortunate that, you know, I have a nice home. I can look out and see the ducks and the chickens and the donkeys and the horses, and everybody seems to be okay. And, you know, and I don't, my wife will come in and say, "Jimmy, you need to get out and mow the lawn." "Okay, I'll get that done." Or, you know, "The porch is rotten. When are you going to get that lumber and get that fixed?" But it's kept me centered. And, you know, many of the people I admire outside of my, you know, my profession have been mainly welders and carpenters and people like that who have helped me to learn, you know, a hobby, and so I could take care of my home and feel good about myself.
Now that you mentioned the word hobby, I want to ask you, you know, with all of your touring and feeding the animals and doing the chores around the house, do you get to spend much time doing your artwork? I'm holding in my hand right now, watching the river run, and there's a beautiful piece of art that you did called Towel's Ladder.
Uh-huh.
And do you get to spend any time, then on your website, you have beautiful watercolors. Do you get to continue to do that? Do you find the time?
Well, you know what? I haven't had the time lately. What I did do... you know, we had a terrible thing happen. We discovered we'd been embezzled for 20 years. And when we moved to Tennessee, we went, "Whoa, you know, where is everything?" So it took me a couple, 2-3 years for us to get financially back where we were okay. And we've dealt with that. The district attorney's office has found the person, and we're hoping real soon that will, you know, end a chapter in our lives. But in the process of getting back and getting everything organized, I've had to pace myself. And the most important thing was to try to get my studio reconstructed without the finances. Fortunately, again, the blessings were I have a wood shop, you know, and I have the tools. And so between myself and some friends, we were able to build this and do this a little bit at a time. I remember once going down to Home Depot looking around for a piece of lumber, and I looked over there and there was a pile of stuff, and I said, "What is that over there?" And they go, "Oh, that's just scraps." And I said, "Well, what are you going to do with them?" And they said, "Well, we're just going to throw them away." And I said, "Well, do you mind if I take them with me?" So, I mean, I took a couple of huge pieces of plywood and some stuff, and we stacked it away, and a year and a half later, as I'm building the studio, all that stuff came into play. So, you know, it's been, again, a journey to get back, and I finally got my studio finished. There's still some things, getting some cameras to work and checking patch bases, mm-hmm. That's done. But since you, you know, ask, I mean, I had all my art stuff in the studio that it's supposed to be in that's been sitting for 4 years. And recently I had an art show of all my works in the Nashville Van Gogh Immersive Gallery.
Part
of the showing. And I had it there for about 6 months, 5 months. But I took it out and I thought I'd like to try to, you know, maybe get it to some other places around. And this weekend we had a meeting with a woman who wants to do an art show with my stuff and some other artists. And it just got me to thinking, I need, when I get back off this tour, I need to get up there and get my art studio done and finish that series of paintings that I did on the Taos Pueblo, which it's all about ladders and perspective. And those particular acrylics that you're looking on were an exercise in only using three colors for everything. So
the blue
is one color, the door is another color, and then the rest of it's the same color with only different variations.
Mm-hmm.
With Titanic white to give you the brightness and Payne's gray to bring in the shadows. So your mind sees a whole lot of colors there, but there's really only three plus the shadowing.
Well, it's. I hope you get back to it because I think there's a lot of talent there just waiting to be explored. You're listening to 88.5 KRFY Community Supported Radio for North Idaho, and we're having a conversation with Jim Messina, who's going to be at the Panada Theater on Sunday, May 21st. And we're excited to have you coming to Sandpoint again.
Well, I'm looking forward to it, too. I remember the last time I was there, one of the most memorable moments we had rented a place it's not really the creek, but it's on the lake and it's mm-hmm. a tributary. And I'm standing out there, and all of a sudden I turn around to go grab some coffee, and I hear this huge splash, like a train fell in the water. and I look over there, and a moose had jumped off a dock. And then I remember taking a boat ride and seeing all these wonderful eagle nests up, mm-hmm. Around. But the most memorable for me was at 2:00 in the morning, hearing these train whistles going on.
Oh, and yeah.
Someone told me there's like 100 different train tracks back there. And every train has a different whistle. Some are 9 chords. Some are diminished flat fives. and they just kind of dwell through the night. But what a wonderful memory that was for me.
Well, the moose are still in town. They're walking around eating people's tulips right now.
Oh, good taste. mm-hmm.
But we're looking forward to, in terms of at the Panada, if I'm not mistaken, you will be the first performer where we have, I'm on the board of the Panada Theater as well as here at the studio, where we have specific seat numbers and row numbers. We've never done that before. It's a sellout. And, and we're so excited that for the first time, in it's going to be a 100-year-old theater in 2027.
Beautiful.
You're the first person to where we've had to, and we're excited about. Usually, it's first come, first serve.
Uh-huh.
And now people are going to come in and have a specific place in which to sit, and people are just excited about you coming here to town and looking forward to it.
Well, I'm all I can say is I'm so pleased that I can bring this band because these guys are so super to play with. They allow me the freedom to be able to do what I do.
Wonderful. And,
so it's a joy for me as well.
And we'll try to book the moose and the eagles for you when you come here.
Yeah, you know what? I've seen the eagles, but I've never heard of the group the moose.
Listen, have safe travels, and what you're leaving shortly for your Pacific Northwest tour.
Yeah, I'll be leaving in the morning.
Okay, have safe travels and good stops along the way, and we'll see you here in Sandpoint.
You bet. Looking forward to it.
Take care, Jim.
Bye-bye.